welcome to Deep North, the official podcast of Iceland Review magazine. Today we'll be listening to staff writer Jelena Cirich read her article Wall of Fire in the latest magazine of Iceland Review, and we'll be discussing her article after she reads.
On Sunday morning, January 14th, around 4:30 a.m., Ari Guðmundsson's phone rang. The Reykjanes Peninsula was trembling. 3.5 hours later, it rang again. This time, it was Víðir Reynisson, the head of Iceland's Civil Protection Department. A fissure had opened, and an eruption had begun. The long earthen lava barriers, of which Ari had led the design and rapid construction, which were meant to protect the evacuated town of Grindavík, and which were still incomplete, were about to go through trial by fire. "I've been somewhat connected to natural disasters," Ari had told me 1 week earlier in his Selfoss office. "I'd driven down for a visit to learn about the lava barriers." Ari is a civil engineer and a division manager of branch offices at Verkís, a consulting engineering firm. His work first brought him close to Iceland's destructive forces in 2000. That year, two powerful M6.5 and M6.6 earthquakes shook the south, the first of their kind in 88 years. While no one was injured, the quakes caused considerable damage to infrastructure. "I started working on a team that was evaluating the damage," Ari told me. In 2008, another earthquake hit the region, and he became project manager of the damage evaluation group. "The same forces that cause Iceland's seismic activity are responsible for its volcanic tendencies. The island straddles the rift between the North American and Eurasian tectonic plates. And as the plates pull apart, the tension created in the Earth's crust builds up. That tension can build quietly for years, decades, or centuries. But it is always, inevitably, released." "We've known for a long time that there's a threat of eruptions on Reykjanes," Ari told me. "That knowledge comes from an awareness of history and an understanding of basic math. In the past, the Reykjanes Peninsula has alternated between periods of seismic and volcanic activity, with seismic periods lasting 600 to 800 years and volcanic periods lasting about 300 years. The last volcanic period, known as the Reykjanes Fires, ended in 1240. When Fagradalsfjall erupted in 2021, it had been nearly 800 years since lava last broke the surface of the peninsula. In other words, it was right on time. Once it became undeniable that the Reykjanes Peninsula was entering a long-awaited volcanic period, the Icelandic government put together a working group to look into whether and how the area's infrastructure could be protected against eruptions. Things had changed on the peninsula since 1240, to say the least. Reykjanes had become home to 30,000 people. It housed the country's only major international airport, two geothermal power plants, and a certain popular lagoon. Much was at stake. Ari chaired the group, which included representatives from the engineering firm Verkís and EPLA, volcanologists from the University of Iceland, and specialists from the Met Office. "Just before the 2021 Fagradalsfjall eruption, we started looking at potential scenarios," Ari explained. "One of our water resource engineers at Verkís, Hörn Hrafnsdóttir, had been using a software program called HECRAS, developed by the U.S. Army to model the flow of water to predict potential lava flow on the Reykjanes Peninsula," he explained. "This modeling helped the group to see how various eruption scenarios might play out on Reykjanes and propose ways to protect key infrastructure." In 2022, they handed in their findings to the Department of Civil Protection and Emergency Management. Those findings included a proposal for the construction of lava barriers around Svartsengi geothermal power plant and the town of Grindavík. The first known human attempt to control lava flow occurred on the island of Sicily in 1669. When Etna erupted and it was clear the flow was heading towards the town of Catania, its inhabitants dug and maintained a gap at the edge of the lava that diverted it away from the town. However, the redirected lava then flowed towards Palermo, whose inhabitants chased the Catanians away so the lava could fill the gap and flow back towards Catania. Through the centuries, humans have attempted to stop or divert the flow of lava with various methods. In 1881, as lava from Mauna Loa advanced toward the Hawaiian town of Hilo, locals set up earthen and rock walls to stop the flow. The eruption stalled on its own before reaching them. In 1929, in the same location, the American volcanologist Thomas Jagger used explosives to attempt to slow the advance of lava. They had little to no effect. Water has also been used to cool and solidify an advancing lava front, in both Hawaii and in Iceland, in the Heimaey eruption of 1973. Perhaps one of the most common methods used to stop eruptions throughout history has been prayer. On July 20th, 1783, when lava threatened to destroy the area around Kirkjubæjarklaustur, southeast Iceland, Reverend Jón Steingrímsson and his parishioners took refuge in a nearby church. Jón delivered a powerful sermon calling on the assembly to accept their fate and turn to God, and miraculously, the lava stopped just before reaching the church. Between March 2021 and August 2023, Reykjanes erupted three times. In each instance, far enough from infrastructure and inhabited areas that lava was not a threat. These eruptions served as learning experiences for the working group, giving them a chance to construct and test small barriers to direct the lava flow. As Ari explains, in 2021, we researched lava barriers in Hawaii and Italy, and one of the lessons we learned was that deflecting dams that guide the flow of lava were more likely to succeed than trying to dam the flow straight on. The group built five small barriers during the 2021 Fagradalsfjall eruption, both dams and deflecting dams, and collected valuable experience on how the lava flowed around them. Then, in October of last year, the ground near Svartsengi power plant began rising. The group was called together again. It was clear that the threat was by Svartsengi and Grindavík, Ari told me. That was a scenario that we had considered in 2021, so we pulled up the pre-design we had suggested in our report about lava barriers around these two places. In early November, when it became clear that magma was collecting below Svartsengi, the government approved the building of two lava barriers around the power plant. The way the barriers were built now is more or less what we proposed then, Ari says. In order to make them as small as possible, we proposed placing them along ridges in the landscape, and that basically determined their location. That means the barriers don't need to be built as high as if they had been down in a valley. It seems remarkable that the barriers capable of directing the flow of molten lava are essentially piled up earth. Around half of the material was mined from nearby mountains, while the other half was bulldozed on location. The Svartsengi barriers, around 20 to 30 meters wide at their base, 6 to 8 meters tall, and 4 kilometers and 1.5 kilometers long, were virtually completed within 40 days. The Svartsengi barriers are around 560,000 cubic meters and were constructed in just over a month, Ari observed. It's a huge collective achievement, and it's thanks to the collaboration of many parties, which has gone extremely well. Not only are the lava barriers around Svartsengi and Grindavík a huge achievement, they also come at a huge cost. The Svartsengi barriers are projected to cost around ISK 2.5 to 3 billion, which is around 18 to 22 million US dollars or 17 to 20 million euros. And the Grindavík barriers, when fully completed, are projected to cost around double that amount, ISK 6 billion. Part of that cost will be financed through a new additional tax on property owners to be levied for 3 years. Critics have pointed out that such taxes tend to become permanent. After the Heimaey eruption in 1973, the government raised sales tax by 2% to help fund rebuilding in the Westman Islands. The hike was supposed to be temporary, but was never rescinded. However the barriers are to be funded, they undeniably come with a significant price tag. Is that price worth it? For Ari, the answer is clear. Definitely, he says. If you put it in context with the buildings and the important infrastructure that are at stake, then it's not a lot of money. And not just if you consider the value of what we're trying to protect, but the cost of the potential consequences if we don't. If 30,000 people suddenly don't have hot water or heating in their homes, that's a consequence that's very difficult to deal with. Even without lava damaging Svartsengi or Grindavik, the consequences of the ongoing volcanic activity have been far-reaching. Securing temporary housing for Grindavik's 3,600 evacuated residents has proven challenging for Icelandic authorities. Businesses located in the town, many within the fishing industry, are scrambling to find ways to continue operating. While the government has provided short-term financial assistance for Grindavik residents, it is now drafting long-term support measures, which may include buying out Grindavik property owners who wish to relocate elsewhere permanently. Finance Minister Þórdís Kolbrún has made it clear that such decisions will impact Iceland's economy at large, potentially affecting other economic goals, such as curbing persistent inflation. These crucial decisions need to be made without knowing when or where the next eruption will hit the area, despite the inevitable curves on the road ahead. When I met Ari just over a week before the January eruption, he showed me technical drawings of the barriers around Grindavik. On the page, they look like two shallow offset arches. The road into the town would be modified to curve around the outer barrier and doubled back behind the inner one in an S-bend. That way the lava can flow past the opening without running behind the barrier, Ari explained. Our suggestion is to build barriers on both sides of the town so we can direct the lava both west and east toward the sea, depending on where it comes from. Of course, the lava will go over some roads and things we can't protect, but we're trying to protect the majority of infrastructure. That's our starting aim. By January 14th, one part of the barrier to the north of Grindavik had been built up to half its planned height, around 4 to 5 meters, or 13 to 16 and a half feet. The fissure opened directly across it, its southern end stretching into the area meant to be protected. Around noon, another smaller fissure opened within the barrier, just outside the town limits. The eruption petered out within a day, but not before lava destroyed three homes at the town's edge. Despite the tragedy, the barrier had successfully deflected the lava on its outer side, away from Grindavik. After the eruption ended, I called Ari and asked if it had been a disappointment to learn that the fissure had breached the barrier. Ever the engineer, he answered, "It was more just a fact." I asked if the barriers had ever made him wax philosophical about man versus nature. Is it hubris for humans to even attempt to control one of the Earth's most powerful and violent forces? This project is definitely at the limit of what we're capable of when it comes to dealing with natural forces, Ari answered. We're at the intersection of what is possible to control and what isn't. And we're aware that we can't control all possible scenarios. We're trying to address as many as we possibly can, the ones which we have some possibility to protect ourselves against. And we consider that in these locations, it's worth trying. In one sense, January's eruption was historic and unprecedented. But in another sense, it was representative of human survival on this island, where the forces of nature, whether eruptions, earthquakes, glacial floods, or storms, remind inhabitants that their survival is conditional. It might be more humble, perhaps even more realistic, to yield to nature's upper hand. But perhaps there's nothing more human, or indeed more true to the Icelandic temperament, than attempting to overcome it.
The Heimaey eruption. Although Iceland experiences eruptions every 3 to 6 years, on average, only once before has one occurred next to a densely inhabited area. On January 23, 1973, a volcanic fissure opened on Heimaey, the only inhabited island in the Westman Islands archipelago, off the coast of South Iceland. The island's 5,300 inhabitants were safely evacuated by fishing vessels that were luckily in the harbor when the fissure opened. The eruption continued for over 6 months, destroying or heavily damaging nearly one-third of the town's buildings. While many residents eventually returned to Heimaey to rebuild, some settled elsewhere in Iceland permanently. Grindavik was one of those locations. A neighborhood of prefabricated houses was constructed in the town for displaced residents of Heimaey. Well, thank you for that, Ilna.
Thank you.
So this article that you wrote is obviously dealing with a moving target, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah.
Things are developing rapidly, and even while you were writing the article, there was an eruption, and a lot has happened since the article has been published. Can you tell us a little bit about the current situation?
That's right. So within the writing of the article, after I initially spoke to Ari, the eruption happened, which I do mention in the article, the January eruption. Since then, there's been one more eruption in the area in February that was closer to Svartsengi power plant and further from the town of Grindavík. So that eruption, the lava from that eruption flowed over Grindavíkurvegur, the main road that goes into the town of Grindavík, and also the turnoff to the Blue Lagoon, which is right by the power plant. So that was a huge development. Now authorities and the road administration are building a new road into Grindavík, since that one has lava covering it currently, making it really difficult for people to access Grindavík. Another development has been that as of actually today, the day we're recording this podcast, Grindavík residents are permitted to stay overnight in Grindavík, but it is at their own risk. So authorities are permitting people to do that if they so choose, but they're not recommending it, for example, for children. The town is still crisscrossed with all kinds of crevices that are sometimes difficult to spot and can be incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, and we also saw in this most recent eruption that the Njarðvíkur conduit, sort of the main hot water pipeline that delivers hot water to all of the towns on the Reykjanes Peninsula, ruptured. And that was that had some pretty huge implications on residents. And luckily, they've since fixed the pipeline and
They built a new pipeline, well, which was already in the works, actually, but they managed to complete it really in record time in order to supply all these 30,000 residents with water, with hot water, which is also what is used to heat houses on the entire peninsula. And that is one of the scenarios that Ari actually mentioned in this article. You know, if this infrastructure is damaged and all these people lose hot water, it's a situation that is really difficult to deal with. And has actually been dealt with surprisingly well and was solved within a few days, really. But, you know, largely thanks to the fact that we were already thinking about this scenario and preparing for this scenario and already had started the construction of a new pipeline, which turned out to be absolutely necessary. And so another development that's also happened since that that time and the writing of this article is that the government has actually introduced some long-term measures for residents of Grindavík, where they are offering to buy up their property, basically at the insurance value of the property, or 95% of the fire insurance value. But that's, as far as I understand, is only available for residential properties. So residents who own their own housing, their property in the town. There's been a lot of talk of businesses in the town who have been struggling to keep their operations running, have been calling for more access to the town, which, I mean, they do have somewhat as of today. So we'll see how that develops in the future. But there's also been quite a lot of talk of if businesses are not able to keep running in the town, it's something that could potentially spell the death or decline of the community itself if businesses decide to move away from Grindavík. So there's a lot of different considerations, both in the short term and the long term, of how to protect this infrastructure, how to ensure that this community can continue to live and thrive, but at the same time, give individuals and businesses the option to relocate if that's what is best for them.
Yeah, and I mean, these are very much sort of questions that are difficult to answer. I glean from the interviews that have been given by residents that many residents of Grindavík obviously don't foresee returning, not in the near future or maybe ever, given how dangerous the area is with all the crevices. I mean, families with children are not particularly enthused about returning to such a dangerous area. So, yeah, I mean, it's a matter of waiting and seeing. And I wanted to touch on, as you mentioned, sort of the insurance value because in your article, you mentioned that, you know, these barriers come at a significant cost. So I think for the Schwarzenegger barriers, those are the barriers around the geothermal power plant. They're estimated to cost, somewhere around 3 billion Icelandic krona, $20 million. And the cost of the barriers around Grindavik are, they're about twice as expensive, $6 billion, $45 million. But it's important to put that number in context. So do we know the estimated value of the insured property, facilities, infrastructure, et cetera?
Well, there is one figure I found in my research that was estimating the insurance value of property within Grindavik alone. So things like insured housing, personal assets, so the port facilities, and things like that within the town of Grindavik. And that figure was 154 billion ISK. So many, many times over the cost of building these barriers. And that figure doesn't even include public infrastructure like roads and sidewalks and plots of land. It just includes specifically insured property. So as Ari was saying, I mean, and there are obviously volcanic areas all around the world, but it is quite rare to be in a situation where there is such valuable infrastructure within such a volcanically active area. And, you know, it's this double-edged sword where we have this incredible risk and danger. But at the same time, the reason that we've developed this infrastructure in this area is because of this geothermal activity. And we've got two power plants because there is this incredibly valuable energy source that we can use to create all sorts of value, both in terms of for the quality of life of residents, but also, you know, energy that many businesses rely on, and that, you know, it impacts the Icelandic economy in quite a big way. So when all of that is taken into account, the cost of building these barriers is not actually so great. And another thing that I found really interesting when I was looking at these barriers and sort of their geographic location and reality is that there's not a lot around Grindavik that would need necessarily protecting. There's a lot of kind of barren lava fields. And so it's very possible to divert the lava away from the town into an area where there's less infrastructure. That's much more difficult in a more densely populated country or place like, you know, Sicily, around Etna, as we know in this case from 1669 that I mentioned. Once the lava was diverted away from one town, it was suddenly going toward another town, you know, and that's not the case around Grindavik. So I think we're very lucky in many ways that we can even build these barriers, that we have somewhere else to divert the lava, that we have the material on location in order to build the barriers. And of course, you know, the reasoning of there, it really is worth it if you look at it purely economically.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, like you mentioned, obviously the peninsula has changed dramatically since the Reykjanes fires from the 13th century. But even though it's densely populated today, it's still very sparse
not
in comparison.
Not quite as dense as some other parts of the world, perhaps.
Exactly, yeah. It was interesting. The Prime Minister, Katrin Jakobsdottir, delivered this sort of oral report on the geological unrest on the peninsula last week in front of Parliament. And she characterized what was going on and what is coming as the greatest challenge the Republic has faced since its founding. And she also mentioned how, I don't know if you actually visited or seen these protective barriers with your own eyes, but as someone who's only seen them from pictures, she described sort of driving through the area and seeing how the landscape had totally altered in the space of 2 or 3 years. Did you go yourself, by curious, to see the barriers with your own eyes?
I was not able to go by myself just because of these access restrictions. But we've got some pretty great pictures, which our listeners can also check out on our website, that accompanied the article. And it is really remarkable that even though kind of working with the ridges that are already in the landscape, of course, putting up these huge barriers is going to dramatically change the landscape. And it's something that under normal circumstances would have required a much longer development time and much more evaluation in terms of environmental impact and visual impact. But just because of what was at stake and because of the imminent risk involved, it was a project that was allowed to proceed actually very quickly. So I can imagine that actually being there on location and seeing these huge barriers that just a few months ago weren't there is really impactful.
Yeah, I mean, just because these are abstract figures, you know, I believe they're 6 to 8 meters high. I mean,
that's quite
high. Mm-hmm. So I'm always interested. I mean, writing something like this obviously involves a lot of research and talking to people. And I mean, one of the things that inevitably happens is that, you know, you come away from an article with maybe a new view of the situation. What is the most important takeaway for you from writing the piece? What has sort of changed post writing?
I think maybe in the beginning of the Reykjanes Peninsula kind of awakening from its volcanic slumber, if we can say, it felt like something that was very localized with the first Fagradalsfjall eruption in 2021. You know, it was called a tourist eruption. It was in a really convenient location, actually quite far from infrastructure. It lasted a long time. People, you know, went and saw it and, you know, kind of enjoyed it. And it didn't really have much negative impact. But as these eruptions have continued, and we've been told that they will most likely continue in the coming years, decades, maybe even centuries, we've seen that the impact is much broader than just this area and then just the Reykjanes Peninsula. And we've seen that in terms of what's happened in the most recent eruptions with the infrastructure being damaged, with, you know, first of all, 3,600 people having to leave their town and find somewhere else to live. And then 30,000 people having their hot water and heating cut off by an eruption. But we're also starting to see, as the Prime Minister mentioned, you know, wider economic impacts in Iceland with these response measures that are so necessary and needed for the residents of Grindavík. Of course, they're going to have an economic impact on the country as a whole. And there's also been discussion. I asked Ari whether it was important to consider protective barriers elsewhere in Iceland, as we know that these eruptions are most likely going to continue. And he did say that the working group proposed at least considering and researching whether it makes sense to build barriers on other parts of the Reykjanes Peninsula, for example, around the town of Vogar. That was one location that was considered, but also closer to the capital area as well, because we know that these five volcanic systems across the Reykjanes Peninsula can actually stretch closer toward the capital area, toward the town of Hafnarfjörður, for example. And although he didn't say that at this point, it was clear that more productive barriers were necessary, he said that it was definitely important to do more research and look into that possibility in the future. And of course, considering the value of the infrastructure just in the town of Grindavík alone, of course, the capital area being more populated and having even more infrastructure is also very worthy of protection if we're looking at it economically speaking.
Right. And am I right in understanding that we are waiting for some kind of, I mean, the working group is working on sort of larger, more comprehensive hazard map for the entire capital area. And we're waiting on sort of, I mean, they've already released parts of that plan, but I think they're expecting to finish it this year or the next. Do you know?
I believe so. I don't know the details of that specific research, but it's definitely something that the government is looking into in more detail right now. There's also been talks of establishing a national fund for emergencies like this one, so that there would be a financial kind of backing that could be accessed if emergencies like this occur, as they do very often in Iceland. So I think these events have definitely led the government to think more actively about long-term measures as well as short-term measures. As I mentioned, when the eruptions began in 2021, it seemed like something that was quite localized, but it definitely will affect the wider Icelandic nation in many ways, I think. So that's something that we're just starting to see and starting to understand and starting to respond to as a nation.
Yeah, I mean, there are some pretty interesting years ahead, it seems like. So I think this has been extremely enlightening. Thank you for reading the piece and for this edifying conversation.
Likewise, it's a fascinating topic, and I think we're going to be writing and speaking about it a lot more in the coming years.
Definitely. Deep North is the official podcast of Iceland Review, Iceland's longest-running English-language magazine, focusing on nature, politics, and community. Check it out wherever you listen to podcasts.